Welcome back. To this point, we've examined the development of states and civilization in and around the valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates River in Mesopotamia. We'll now turn our gaze to the west, to another river valley, that of the Nile, and to the development of classical Egyptian civilization. Now, as you see on the image, the satellite image of the Eastern Mediterranean and the Near East, these two regions, Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley, are actually not that far apart. And so this raises a situation of extraordinary interest. States and their accoutrements, writing, monumental architecture, the whole panoply of kingship and rule appear in the Nile Valley at almost exactly the same time as they do in Mesopotamia by about 3000 BC. Thus, the two cases are often compared with one another in order to detect commonalities and differences. This is natural. I mean, these are the two earliest, well-known, well-developed states, civilizations on Earth, and they appear at the same time in the same part of the world, and actually, as we're going to see, in similar kinds of environmental conditions. So it's not surprising at all under those circumstances that we're going to look for commonalities, for common features, and for differences between the two areas, and there certainly are both. One thing we have to note here as well, though, that very proximity raises the question of relationships between these two areas, between Mesopotamia and Egypt in the past. We have to ask ourselves if some of these similarities, for example, between the two areas, if indeed the coincidence of timing for state formation in both areas is actually a coincidence, or if it depended, if in some degree it was the result of contact between the two areas. This is a question that we're going to consider at more depth. I'll put it aside for now, and we'll come back to it. If I go back to an earlier lecture, I note that to a significant degree, archaeology began as a discipline in the Nile Valley, with the investigations of Napoleon's philosophes, those members of the intelligentsia who he brought with him in his invasion of Egypt. And the pyramids are not the only archaeological sites to have battles named after them. Here we have the Battle of the Pyramids, but they're perhaps the most famous ones. With the decipherment of the Rosetta Stone, this one object that so dramatically accelerated our understanding of ancient Egyptian writing. And the depredations of early archaeologists, I would put that in quotes, like Giovanni Battista Belzoni. This very early development of archaeology in Egypt has been both Egyptology's blessing and its curse. Its blessing because it really is in this area that we get the first progress of archaeologists towards understanding societies dramatically different from Western ones without the sort of continuing consciousness that existed for Greek and Roman society, for example. Even through the Middle Ages, and certainly in the Renaissance, there was a consciousness in Europe that Greek and Roman society had existed in the past, that it took particular forms. This did not exist in anywhere near the same sense for Egypt. And we have to remember, even from that point of view, that we are far closer in time to the Romans than they are, than they were to Egyptians at 3000 BC. This is also the first case in which we begin to gain that knowledge of the past through decipherment of a hitherto unknown language. Ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. That's the blessing. The curse was the activities of freebooters, plunderers, like Belzoni. This involved the beginnings of the systematic plunder, and that's not too strong a word, of the Ottoman Empire and other parts of the world for archaeological treasures to feed Western museums through the 19th century. Here is Belzoni, the provider of the statue of Ramses II, the inspiration of those grand words of Shelley's Ozymandias, "I am Ozymandias, King of Kings." Here's Belzoni in his own words. "Nearly overcome, I contrived to sit, but when my weight bore upon the body of an Egyptian, it crushed it like a bandbox. I sank altogether among the broken mummies with a crash of bones, rags, and wooden cases, which raised such a dust as kept me motionless for a quarter of an hour, waiting till it subsided again." This is not thought of as good archaeological research technique. In fact, it sounds fairly disgusting. There's the blessing and the curse of the precocious development of Egyptology. We're going to examine the origins of the Egyptian state and Egyptian civilization in more or less the same way as I did for Mesopotamia, by examining their beginnings in more egalitarian and less centralized farming societies. We probably know less about the Egyptian pre-dynastic, that period before the undoubted appearance of states, or a state, in Egypt, than we do about the equivalent periods, the Ubaid and Uruk periods, for example, in Mesopotamia. Even though, I must say, research in the latter area, in Mesopotamia, has been, of course, significantly affected, significantly hampered by political developments and warfare over the last 30 years. This is something we do need to keep in mind in Mesopotamia. We have to ask ourselves, these wonderful sites along the Tigris and Euphrates, when will the next archaeological project take place there? They do, actually, at this point, in Syria, Iran, and so on, generally with European archaeological teams taking the lead. When we want to think about this relative lack of interest, lack of knowledge about the Egyptian pre-dynastic, when we look for reasons for that phenomenon, this lack of data, they include a preoccupation among Egyptologists with the dynastic period, and especially with sites associated with Egyptian elites, pharaohs, members of the nobility, and also from an over-reliance on the historical traditions and king lists translated from Egyptian hieroglyphics and resulting lack of interest in archaeological techniques like radiocarbon dating. Egyptologists in the past, I'm not talking about the present, but in the past, have been relatively dismissive of these archaeological techniques because they have felt that they have not had to use them. I've talked about these kind of problems in earlier lectures. In a sense, Egyptology suffered to some degree from the spectacular nature of the elite archaeological record. There's also the factor in Egyptology, more or less obsolete assumption that Egyptian civilization was to a great degree introduced from, or at least influenced by, Mesopotamia, and was thus in some sense derivative. I referred to this at the beginning, the proximity of the two areas of the Tigris and Euphrates valleys and the Nile Valley this question of relationships between the two of them, there was often in the past an assumption that culture and civilization had, in a sense, flowed from Mesopotamia to the Nile Valley. We now know that that's not the case. It's also a little ironic because the Greeks, for example, certainly believed that Egyptian civilization was the oldest in the world. Some of these issues, an increased attention, perhaps even an over-attention to the dynastic period, an over-reliance on written records, also existed in Mesopotamia, but they seem to have been more prevalent in Egypt. To an even greater degree than in Mesopotamia, cultural developments in Egypt were linked to the Nile, a long, relatively straight river, today flanked by barren and inhospitable desert. In many ways, if you want to think of the Nile Valley in Egypt, think of it as a long oasis in the desert. The river itself and its seasonal floods were a central part, an absolutely central part of Egyptian culture before the building of the Aswan High Dam at the end of the 1950s and the creation of Lake Nasser. In some ways, even more central to Egyptian society than were the Tigris and Euphrates in Mesopotamia, because the Nile is so singular and the deserts around it are so extreme. To some degree, then, it's going to help us to understand this reliance, cultural reliance, agricultural reliance on the Nile. It's going to help us to understand how it flows. There are two different sources of the Nile. The White Nile flows from the lakes of eastern Africa, from Lake Victoria and surrounding lakes. The flow from the East African lakes is more or less constant throughout the year at relatively low levels. Summer rains on the Ethiopian plateau in the Horn of Africa cause the Nile floods, and these waters are channeled down through particularly the Blue Nile and Atbara rivers to their confluence with the White Nile. These floods begin in June or July, and they end in October or November. They're quite regular. Crops would be planted as soon as the floods receded and harvested some months later. So this very particular rainfall regime in East and Northeast Africa made for floods that were relatively reliable. And the constricted nature of the Nile Valley meant that those floods both watered and fertilized farmland along the Nile in a fairly complete and predictable manner. So the agricultural system, as we're going to see, the agricultural system that was necessary to support civilization in the Nile Valley was not nearly as elaborate as it had to be in Mesopotamia. The Nile Valley is divided into two sections. Upper Egypt, which is actually in the south. It's closer to the headwaters of the river, further to the south, and so is Upper, where the river is narrow and deeply incised. And Lower Egypt in the north, where the valley is wider and easier to navigate. Lower Egypt includes the Nile Delta, beginning at about Cairo, a large triangular area dissected by many small streams as the Nile flows into the Mediterranean. Again, as in Mesopotamia, we have to remember that climates and environments in the Nile Valley changed through the last 10,000 years. And in and around the Nile Valley, if anything, they changed more dramatically than was the case in Mesopotamia. And so I want to take us back a little further than I did in Mesopotamia, because to understand the development of states and civilization in the Nile Valley, we have to have some sense of the changes in occupation of the Nile Valley over the long term. At the beginning of the Holocene, this most recent geological period, the one that we're still in, about 12,000 years ago, rainfall levels increased dramatically over most of Africa, significantly above modern levels, and far above the levels of the preceding period. The preceding period in African prehistory is known as, it has a wonderful term, the terminal Pleistocene hyperarid phase. Great, isn't it? The equivalent period in Europe is called the Ice Age, or at least the latter part of the Ice Age. The terminal Pleistocene hyperarid phase was a period between about 20,000 and 12,000 years ago where climates through much of Africa, and particularly in northern Africa, were far drier than they are now. The Sahara was vastly expanded over its size today. And this is, it's absolutely important for those of us who study African archaeology to understand these climatic changes. Their equivalent importance to the retreat of the Ice Age glaciers in Europe, Asia, and North America. I live at this point in Brunswick, Maine. 14,000 years ago, my house was under a kilometer of ice. Within a few thousand years, that ice, those glaciers, had disappeared. And at that point, my house, the location my house is now, this didn't actually happen to my house. It would have been rather difficult for it. My house, a few thousand years after that, was actually in an expanded Gulf of Maine under tens of meters of seawater. About 1,000 years after that, the location was submerged under sand dunes. A dramatic variety of climates. My little home in Brunswick has had an eventful few millennia from that point of view. In northeastern Africa, along the Nile, the same sort of drama attended this period. We go then from a situation between 20,000 and 12,000 years ago where conditions are far drier, far more arid than they are today, to a period after 12,000 years ago when rainfall levels increased dramatically above those of the present day. At that time, 12,000 years ago, there were communities of hunter-gatherers living along the Nile at various points, exploiting stands of wild cereals and fish and other river resources. This increase in rainfall in the early Holocene, after about 12,000 years ago, had two effects. It caused a series of exceptionally high and quite destructive Nile floods. The wonderful geological term that's used for this, it's called the Wild Nile phase. So there's much more water being pressed into the Nile Valley, both from East Africa and from the Ethiopian Plateau, and it causes these extremely destructive floods. In a situation where living in the Nile Valley during this period of high rainfall would probably have not been very comfortable. This same period, this increase in rainfall, also made the lands to the east and west of the Nile, what are now known as the Western Desert and Eastern Desert of Egypt, far less desert-like, with lakes and river systems around what are now oases in the Western Desert. And part of this area, at least, would have been sort of semi-arid grassland and would have been quite an attractive place to live for humans. So here we have a rather strange result, an increase in rainfall in northeastern Africa, which we tend to think of as a positive thing in this area, makes the areas beyond the Nile Valley more attractive to live in, and because of the increased levels of flooding, makes the Nile Valley itself less attractive to live in. This may account for the fact that the Nile Valley in Egypt seems to have been almost unoccupied between about 10,500 and 7,500 years ago. People were living away from the river in what's now the Sahara. And what I want to note here is that much of the Sahara actually disappears during this period, in the early Holocene, between about 10,000 and 7,000 years ago, much of the Sahara disappears. It's replaced by a grassland with a network of rivers and lakes. This has significant implications for understanding the development of farming in the Nile Valley as compared to that in the Near East and Mesopotamia. Whereas in at least northern Mesopotamia, we have a continuous history of agriculture from more than 10,000 years ago onwards. In the Nile Valley, that history only begins between 7,000 and 6,000 years ago. That is between about 5,500 and 4,000 BC. The time depth of farming in the Nile Valley before the appearance of states is thus much more shallow than in Mesopotamia. Farming hadn't existed for as long in the Nile Valley, which may have helped to account for some differences in the historical development of the two regions. The first undoubted evidence of farming in Egypt actually doesn't come from the Nile Valley at all. That's interesting, given what I've just said. In Nabta Playa, an ancient lake in southern Egypt, about 100 kilometers west of the Nile, archaeologists find substantial settlements of farmers cultivating barley and dating to about 6,000 BC. These farmers may also have had domesticated cattle, but their subsistence base still involved intense use of wild plants and animals. It was probably still a seasonal lake at Nabta Playa at this time, and groundwater that was fairly easy to access, so it's easy to see, or at least understandable, why people would be living there. Barley and cattle are both West Asian domesticates. That is, they form part of the same set of domesticated plants and animals used throughout the Near East and in, for example, Mesopotamia for thousands of years already at that time. It's also striking that the first appearance of these domesticated plants and animals in Egypt is so far away, about 800 kilometers or 500 miles away, from what we might assume to be the logical entryway of those domesticates into Egypt in the Sinai. Further to the north, near the Nile Delta, the first evidence for agriculture comes from an area called the Fayum Depression, which was then a lake about 10 kilometers west of the Nile and 100 kilometers southwest of Cairo. And it only appears in the Fayum at about 4400 BC. Along the Nile itself, the earliest farming village that we know of was found at a site called Merimde, which is about the same age, at the edge of the Nile Delta. So we have to note the significance of this. We have farming in the Fayum, farming at Merimde, at about 4400 BC. Of course, by this point, in Mesopotamia, we'd already had populations, we see populations had been farming already for thousands of years. The site, for example, of Çatalhöyük was occupied 2,000 years before this. We have agricultural populations in northern Mesopotamia more than 2,000 years before this. Well, significantly more than 2,000 years before this. So to find the first agriculture appearing in Egypt at this late time period is quite significant. And as I said, probably has to do with the relative attractiveness of the Nile Valley and the areas around it, now parts of the western and eastern desert, during the early and mid-Holocene, between about 10,000 and 6,000 years ago. Population densities along the Nile during this time period seem to be quite low, even at this late date. It's possible that sites contemporary with Merimde did exist along the Nile, If so, their remains are buried under many tens of meters of alluvial sediments, deposited in the annual Nile floods over thousands of years. You remember that I referred to the difficulty of doing archaeology on the earliest settlements in southern Mesopotamia because of exactly the same circumstance. Because of the deposits of silts and clays and sands as alluvial material by these seasonally flooding rivers. Archaeology in Egypt thus shares this challenge of work along floodplains with research in Mesopotamia. Again, as at Nabta Playa, the early farmers of the Fayum and of Merimde used West Asian domesticates, similar to those used in Mesopotamia. Wheat, barley, flax, used to make linen, cattle, sheep, and goats. Both genetic and archaeological data indicate that cattle were domesticated in the eastern Sahara, independently of their Asian domestication. So the cattle found at sites like the Fayum and even at Merimde may be the only indigenous domesticates in the area. Beyond that, though, beyond agriculture, beyond cattle, as at Nabta Playa, hunting, gathering, and especially fishing continued to be important in these early farming settlements, as indeed it was throughout the Egyptian dynastic period. And that, again, provides an important contrast to Mesopotamia, where hunting, gathering, and fishing were significant at different times in different places, but never so universally significant, so important economically as they were throughout the long span of Egyptian civilization. The Fayum settlements seem to have been fairly large communities, while that at Merimde was much smaller, with houses dug into pits in the ground and then roofed over. Neither the houses nor burials at any of these sites yield evidence for significant degrees of social differentiation. These villages, farming villages, seem to have been largely egalitarian and not subject to any wider political or social authority. In the simple hierarchy of political development that I've already mentioned, band, tribe, chiefdom, state, this would be seen as a tribal level of social organization. The contrast with Mesopotamia at around 4000 BC, where Ubaid communities were developing into those of the expansive Uruk period, and this extraordinarily vital and dynamic Mesopotamian economic, cultural, political system of the time, the contrast between that and these small-scale, relatively egalitarian farming settlements in the Nile Valley is very striking. In Mesopotamia at this time, we have towns of thousands of people, communal architecture, temples, wealth differences, this at least cultural expansionism that made Ubaid and Uruk artifacts items of prestige through much of the Near East. None of that existed in the Nile Valley at the time. During my next lecture, I'll talk about the development of the succeeding period between about 4000 and 3000 BC in the Nile Valley, which we call the pre-dynastic. Thank you.